Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texas Republican elected officials are seeking to block libertarians from getting on the ballot, why a Governor Abbott veto is raising telephone bills in Texas, and being pregnant in rural Texas can be scary due to the lack of maternity care. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas Republicans have filed a petition to knock 23 Libertarian candidates off the November ballot for not paying their filing fees or getting enough signatures to qualify as candidates. Texas Republican elected officials, including Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, filed a petition of mandamus with the Supreme Court of Texas to remove their Libertarian Party of Texas competitors from the November general election ballot. The Republicans complained that the Libertarian candidates are seeking public office, but they are deliberately refusing to pay required filing fees or failing to file their required signature petitions. Whitney Belew is the chair of the Texas Libertarian Party.
My reaction is just like it was last time. This is, you know, another example of the Republican establishment trying to use their authoritarian means to limit voter choice and obstruct or eliminate competition on the ballot. And we're going to resist it.
So when you said last time, because they did this, what, 2 years ago?
They did.
And they lost because the court said that they waited too long to file their objections, but this time they're getting their objections in early, correct?
Well, that may be. There were other reasons why they weren't successful last time. There's definitely some further questions and some interpretation of the code that need to be addressed, and the courts will resolve that. So
let me ask you, did y'all get the signatures? Did you pay the filing fee, or y'all just don't want to do that?
I don't know what you mean by y'all. If you're referring to the 23 who are listed, I can't speak for each and every one of them. There is a record that the relators have put out there from the Secretary of State's website. The question remains to be seen as to whether or not that is a verifiable record. But so I'm not going to comment specifically on any of these, on this particular case, the details of it, but we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Okay.
So are you aware of our federal lawsuit regarding the filing fees?
No.
Billy versus Scott. We have a case pending in the federal courts regarding the filing fees themselves. The filing fees are for third parties are simply unjust. And so for a lot of reasons, we're going to stand up to this tyranny.
So is the view that filing fees are an artificial barrier that are put in the system in order to prevent third parties from being able to be on the ballot?
I think it goes beyond that. I mean, procedurally, the fees are not applied equitably between the convention parties and the primary parties. They're used to actually offset the cost of the primary parties. So the old parties get an actual public benefit from those fees, and the third parties do not. We pay for our own conventions, our own nominating process, and we get no public funding for it. So the way these fees are collected and used is problematic. We're citing 14th Amendment violations in the federal case.
So 23 candidates have been notified in the Republican suit. And is that all the candidates that are on the statewide ballot, or is it just some of them?
That is just some of them. We have 74, 75 candidates statewide on, you know, various ballots. It looks like the Republicans definitely cherry-picked the ones that they wanted off.
That's a lot. 75? I mean, you got a lot of people on the ballot across the state.
We do. We do. I'm very proud of what we've been able to accomplish over the last few years with this. So
the Republicans, they seem to not want you on the ballot. The view is that this could be a really close election for them. They think that you guys could be taking away votes for their side, I guess.
That is what they think.
And can you help us understand what your view is?
Well, our view is with as many people out there who claim to be libertarians, but just don't vote for libertarians, our view is the Republicans and the Democrats still votes from us. So we are well within our rights to be on the ballot. We are a ballot qualified party, have been for years and will be for years to come. And there is no reason that we should have this additional layer of bureaucracy to go through. And quite frankly, it flies in the face of free and fair elections when they're essentially taxing third parties to individually on a candidate basis to even get on the ballot.
So you must hear it all the time, some of these Republican office holders claiming that they hold libertarian views. I mean, I think I've heard Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick claiming to be libertarian at times.
Oh, wow. That's rich.
but they don't run as libertarians. I guess they just stake out that ground when it's convenient for them. How do you see it?
I think they use the libertarian claim when they want to be recognized as small government Republicans. We know that that's not true. And quite frankly, I'll say that in Texas, in terms of Texas politicians, I don't believe there's any such thing as a liberty Republican because of things like this, because of what we're fighting right now. The fact that these legislators get elected and then some of the first things they do is get into that code and figure out how they can start obstructing access to the ballot. And that is not a principle based on liberty. That's not the kind of thing someone who operates in on the principles of liberty would operate. So I don't buy any of it when they claim to be libertarians or liberty leaning or anything like that.
When there are candidates on the ballot for these offices, do you think it brings more people to the polls?
Absolutely. I think in some ways we activate people who, apathetic voters, people who have stopped voting. They don't bother because there's nobody who they feel comfortable voting for. When you cast a vote for someone, you're essentially, what's the word I'm looking for here? You're saying that they speak for you. And that is, a lot of true libertarians just don't see that. They don't ever see that option. And so we feel like at a minimum, we're there to provide that, to give them something that they can go out and vote for instead of just holding their noses to vote for the lesser of two evils, because that's what they're going to get. Either time is just evil if they continue to choose the two old parties. And so we feel like it is our duty to provide that option. We for sure know that lower down the ballot, we tend to get more people who probably would be voting anyway, would vote libertarian when the libertarian option is there. Whether or not they would be casting votes for Republicans or Democrats otherwise, I don't know. Maybe they would just be undervoting. It's hard to get that information.
So you wholeheartedly, categorically reject the idea that a libertarian candidate on the ballot would be a spoiler for Republicans in this very tight election year. I mean, is that correct?
I don't reject that. I think that if that's how they want to characterize it, that's reasonable. But it doesn't make any difference to us. We are not obligated to the Republicans or the Democrats. We are obligated to voters. We are obligated to our constituents. That's who we're doing this for. We're not doing this to protect either one of the old parties. And if they continue to fight over these spots and have to use these kinds of tactics in order to be successful, then they're probably doing something wrong from the get-go. Maybe if more people were voting libertarian, Republicans and Democrats would actually have to start working to get elected.
So if there are voters who believe in limited government, want to keep the government out of our bedrooms, and they're tired of the MAGA, Trump politics and stuff, do you think that the Libertarian Party is the right fit for them?
Absolutely do. The limited government thing is number one. There is no way we will ever get that under either one of the old parties. That's just not going to happen. They have no reason to deliver on that because they continue to get elected no matter what. And so they can continue to lie and pretend to be small government and then get into office and continue to expand government and increase spending, fail to lower taxes. They can keep getting away with all that. And in the meantime, trying to keep us off and out of the way and out of debates. Because as soon as people start hearing from libertarians in these debates, it's really hard to go back to accepting what the Republicans and the Democrats are selling. And, you know, they on a debate stage, the Republicans and Democrats can look at each other and point at each other and you know, cite all of these things that their parties have done wrong. And they're both correct. But they can't look at a libertarian and say, yeah, but look what they did. Because we don't know yet. And as soon as they know what libertarians can do, I don't think there's any going back from that. That is when they actually start to get a sense of what freedom might actually be, what limited government might actually be. And until they start voting, I mean, that's what it's going to take to win. That's what it's going to take to get libertarians elected is people, you know, over a third of the population voting for libertarians. And that's what we're here to do is help make that happen.
Whitney Belew is the chair of the Texas Libertarian Party. Your telephone bill could be going up in Texas due to the need to maintain the Texas Universal Service Fund surcharge. Don Richards is an attorney with the TSTCI, the Texas Statewide Telephone Cooperative Incorporated, a statewide association of small rural telephone cooperatives and companies. He explains why this charge is going up.
This is what we'd refer to as a self-imposed problem by the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission is charged with collecting the money, setting a rate on phone bills and collecting the money from the Universal Service Fund and then dispersing it to the companies that the commission has found need the money based on what they've proven how much they need. Under the law that was set down by the legislature, it started in June of 2020. The small companies, rural companies, began to notice the fund was declining, very rapidly for some reason, the balance in the fund. Approached the commission about it, and the commission staff recommended the commission raise the assessment rate from 3.3 cents a dollar on a phone bill up to 6.4, I believe is what it was, in June of 2020. The commission refused to make that change, even though our argument was the law required them to do so. They refused to make that change, and by December, the fund ran low enough that it could not pay all the required disbursements that the commission had previously ordered. So they just let it run low, and everybody dropped down, and all the companies, the rural telephone companies, dropped down to where they were collecting as low as 15% of what had been ordered that they were supposed to receive. The small companies filed in court, and also we filed a bill with the legislature, and the legislature went through and amended the law and changed it and fixed the problem that the commission, we contend, refused to look at. But the legislature found a legislative fix and fixed the problem, but the governor vetoed it. So we went ahead and continued our court fight, and then on June 30th, the Court of Appeals ruled that the commission did not follow the law, had made a mistake, had gone about it procedurally all wrong, and ordered them to raise the assessment rate on phone bills up to a level required not only to fund everybody to the current level they ought to, but to also pay all back the arrearage of now up to $200 million. So we're coming up right at 2 years since they have made the order, but a year and a half since the funding ran out. It's up to over $200 million in arrearages. So they ordered them to pay that. The commission chose to immediately raise the assessment rate up to a very high level, 24%. So it went from 3.3% up to 24%. And that's what's causing the issue on phone bills. One of the things I guess I'd like to say is this is not a rural versus an urban issue. The rural companies need it, but it's for the statewide network, and the network provides calls across the state, both data and phone, and it helps provide for that network, and so it's equally good for both rural and urban areas. The rural and urban areas do get support from this fund to keep the networks up in their area, but the network is statewide. And so it helps every consumer in the state be able to make phone calls, complete phone calls, not just the rural areas.
So we had House Bill 2667, which was passed
Correct.
By the legislature, went to Governor Abbott's desk for him to sign. That would have raised this rate to 6%-ish. And Governor Abbott, he vetoed it.
He vetoed it. He would not have raised the rate. He vetoed it. Now, I'll give you some background on that. The legislature fixed it. The fact that the fund was declining was due to something else, and the legislature fixed that problem. And so that would have all required the commission to collect funds, sufficient funds. It did not change the rate, but it did fix the problem. I'll be glad to explain that to you. It's relatively simple, but...
Okay, well, give me a really quick explanation.
All right. The legislature knew in June of 2020, and this is one of the things we tried to tell them, some of the phone companies quit paying in their assessment on VoIP, V-O-I-P, Voice Over Internet Protocols. Many business line in the state now don't use traditional phone lines. It goes out over the Internet. And some companies determined that was not under the exact wording of the statute, so they quit paying in the assessment. They quit, in other words, the state wasn't collecting as much money. They said it wasn't applicable to VoIP, V-O-I-P, phone lines. The legislature passed a bill and said, yes, the USF should be assessed on VoIP lines as well as regular telephone lines. So the legislature fixed the problem. The governor vetoed that. So we didn't. The contributions to the fund declined, and the legislature fixed that problem. That was primarily the reason for the decline. The law says that everybody who has access to the customer base has to pay the assessment. But we had some phone companies who quit making the assessment on VoIP telephones. Well, these days, nearly every business phone is technically, legally a VoIP phone.
That's why when the Internet goes out, we lose our phones, too.
That's correct. You know, it's just a change in technology, but the phones work the same to the average customer. But it was a technical determination by a number of larger phone companies that they weren't going to pay it on VoIP.
Okay, so House Bill 2667 was going to fix that, and everyone was going to have to pay this fee.
Go back to paying the way they had been, before they interpreted it differently.
And then Greg Abbott said no, veto.
He vetoed it.
So
without reason, we really don't know why.
Can I say that the reason why we're getting this 24% increase in this charge is because Greg Abbott's veto?
Well, it's two reasons. Greg Abbott, that could have fixed the problem. It started with the commission, not raising the assessment up to 6% in June of 2020. That would have avoided this problem with the background and the arrearages that they owe. And we came up, while that was pending in court, we said this is an easy fix, and the legislature overwhelmingly passed it, 31 to unanimous in the Senate. It was like 130-15 in the House. Just overwhelmingly passed it because the legislature said, yes, you should be making this assessment on VoIP phones as well as regular telephones and cell phones and all that. And it would have fixed it, but I don't know, Governor Abbott vetoed that. Now, he didn't start the problem. He could have fixed it and chose to veto it instead. And now the court then came back and said, yes, PUC, the court decision didn't have anything to do with Abbott's vetoing it. It would have avoided it. The problem would have been avoided. But the court ordered the PUC, you're under requirement to raise enough money to pay everybody that you say is entitled to the funds, all these small companies. So now the court ordered the PUC to do it, and so the PUC has done what the court ordered, and for at least for the next year, unless nothing else changes, it'll be at 24% or less. Hopefully, if we can get the legislature again to address it and pass it again, the VoIP, that would broaden the contribution base and lower it back down. it's two ways. You know, you can raise enough, you can put a high enough assessment on to raise the money, or you can broaden the people that pay into the fund. Now, in the early part of 2020, we had a lot of people quit paying into the fund because it was they quit assessing it on VoIP phones.
Right.
They made that decision, and the commission did not, commission let it go.
So this was a problem that we didn't have to have.
That's absolutely correct.
So
commission could have fixed it in June 2020, or the governor could have not vetoed the bill, and it would have been fixed. To meet their legal obligations, it had to go to 24% to pay not only the current ongoing amount to keep get the fund back running again, but to pay the arrearages. All these rural phone companies have basically shut down all their development, all their maintenance, quit hiring people. They stayed alive. They hadn't had to go bankrupt, but they quit developing and maintaining the network like it needs to be developed. You know, and the commission has changed. The commissioners that are there now did not cause this problem. That was by three commissioners who resigned in light of that winter storm we had. So we got three new commissioners. They didn't cause the problem. They did fix it quick, but they raised the rate to 24%.
So the 24%, is that 24% of my overall bill?
No. It's 24% of your Texas-related revenues. That's basically your local rate. If you pay... If your local phone bill, you have to have a landline phone. If your landline phone costs you $25 a month, it'll be 25% of that charge. Doesn't include your cell phone charges and your cost of service. It's just whatever your local phone usage to have that phone. You have that phone in your office, regardless whether you ever make a single phone call, you pay $25 or something for having the phone. That's what the charge is on. So it's not on the total bill. It's on the basic phone charge.
Okay, so that's easier to swallow. Thank goodness.
Yes.
Don Richards is an attorney for the TSTCI, the Texas Statewide Telephone Cooperative Incorporated. Giving birth in rural Texas isn't as safe as it should be because there is a lack of maternity care in lower populated counties in the state. Texas leads the U.S. in maternity ward closures, and nowhere is this more of an issue than in the western part of the state. John Henderson is the president and CEO of TORCH, Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals.
We've seen a deterioration in OB services in rural areas of Texas for the last generation. You know, 20 years ago, roughly 60% of the rural hospitals in Texas provided OB services and delivered babies. Today, that percentage has flipped, and it's 40% that do deliver babies, and 60% of our rural hospitals don't.
Does it seem like it's a vicious cycle here, vicious circle? If there's a lack of maternal care in these areas, then it's less likely that people will move to these areas, and so it kind of puts the whole space on a downward slide?
Yeah, I don't know that I would describe it as a vicious cycle. I would describe it as, you know, financial and operational pressure that these small community hospitals are under, and they look at services. But when they have to cut OB services specifically, you know, they stop meeting all the needs of their community. And the thing that comes along with OB services is, you know, well, child visits in your clinic and family practice type primary care. So it's not just the delivery, it's the things that go along with the delivery.
But if you want young people to move into an area and they want to start a family, and then they look at, well, the closest OB services are going to be an hour plus drive away, maybe 2 hours, that's not an incentive.
The further you are from care, the harder that conversation becomes. You're right.
So you would think, as we want to make our rural areas healthy and vibrant and robust, and I think it is the future of Texas, that we would put investment there.
Well, that's right. I would add that during the pandemic, as we've learned how to work from anywhere. And as we keep expanding broadband access to rural parts of Texas, that, you know, rural Texas becomes a desirable place to work. But you've got to be able to meet people's health care needs as well.
What is the driver for the reduction in the amount of maternal care that we have in rural Texas?
It has changed. Historically, the driver has been low Medicaid reimbursement, but that's an area where I actually have to give our state legislature some credit. They stepped in during the 2019 legislative session and added $16 million a year in targeted rural Medicaid rate enhancement for OB services. That amounts to about $500 additional per delivery, which we, of course, celebrate. And I felt like it gave these rural hospitals a foothold. It didn't make the service line profitable, but it really did help. More recently, the pressure has been staffing and just having enough nurses to be able to staff the unit and provide the care that you need. So it shifted from a more of a financial conversation to a workforce conversation.
But Texas does lead the nation in maternity ward closures. Other states have big rural areas, but Texas seems to be doing the worst job at trying to maintain this important service.
We lead the nation in rural hospital closures, and we lead the nation in rural OB service line closures or suspensions. But part of that is because we have more hospitals than any other state. I'm not sure that we would be the leader in terms of percentages.
Well, what does this mean for women in rural areas who are thinking about having a child or they're going to have a child? What do they have to consider?
It's an added layer of, I would think, stress for an expectant mother. Especially the further they get from a hospital where they can access that care. You know, you always hope for simple, straightforward, healthy deliveries, but you don't always get that. And, of course, it's not something that can be scheduled and anticipated. So you got to be able to provide the care when that mother needs it. And there are some parts of rural Texas, especially as you go far west Texas, that mothers can find themselves a long way from the care that they need.
Is there something of a policy change that you're asking for that would help address this problem?
Yeah, we're a big proponent of loan forgiveness for nurses who choose to live and work and serve in rural underserved areas of the state. So we see that as a recruiting tool and an advantage for rurals as they try to attract the nursing staff that they need. There are similar programs for physicians, but we need more of that funding for nursing positions.
That can be done at the state level?
Yes, sir.
John Henderson is the president and CEO of TORCH, Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. Plus, you can download Texas Matters wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.